Nuku 91 is Erin Matariki Ka. Matariki, as she prefers to go by, is the co-lead for River, revitalising Indigenous values for Earth's regeneration, and co-manager for the New Zealand Alternative. She is also project manager for Te Kaunoti Hikahika, or E Hika, a constitutional reform project rolling out across Aotearoa. Based in Tāne Atua, this phenomenal wahine spends her time supporting both people and planet to thrive. In this episode, we talk about connecting the global Indigenous community, the whakaaro behind constitutional reform, and why each of her sisters carry the name of our most popular star cluster. Whakarongo mai. Kia ora, I'm Kiane. Nuku is a movement. We're empowering Indigenous wahine to be agents of change, cultivating opportunities to shape the world we want. Through this series, we are meeting 100 kick-ass Indigenous wahine doing things differently. They show us how the world can be shaped by our unique Indigenous voice. It's all about who we are and not who we've been told to be. Nuku, mahine, mohine, kiahine. Kia ora te whānau, welcome back to another episode of Nuku. We are so close. We are so close to the Nuku 100. It's kind of exciting and really scary all at the same time because we have been on such a big journey, and today we are on another haerenga. We've come down here to Tāne Atua, and we're in this beautiful gallery here in Tāne Atua, which is a gallery / whare / all of these amazing things that it is. And having a kōrero today with the beautiful Erin Matariki Ka, tēnā koe e hoa.
Kia ora, Kiane. Welcome. Nau mai.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be in Tāne Atua. It is a beautiful day outside, so I have to say we were all a bit, all these Aucklanders were a bit worried about the cold, but the weather's been put on. This is part of your whakapapa, this whenua here, and is a huge part of who you are, and that's always where we start. Who are you and where are you from? So ko wai koe no hi a koe.
Oh, kia ora no mai hara mai ki tēnei whare.
And this is the realities of living in a small town.
Yeah, so that is the siren across the road. There's no tidal wave, it's not an emergency, but something's happened. Sorry, whānau.
So what we might do is we're going to go on pause, and the next time you hear us, the siren will be off and we're going to finish the kōrero. Yeah, so hang on a second. Hang on, so we're cutting back in here. So for those that are listening, it's just going to sound a bit disjointed, but how long was that? Like 3 minute, 4 minute break?
Yeah.
Of possibly even longer than that of us just waiting for the siren to end. So welcome to Tāne Atua.
No mind, welcome.
That was just your karanga, eh?
Yeah. Just want to welcome you properly, you know? Give a feel for the whole space.
Was you were just starting to tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from.
Yeah. So, kia ora. So, I te taho tōku kuia, ko pitawa ki te maunga, ko rangitai ki te awa, ko te pahipoto te hapū, ko kokohino te marae, ko Ngāti Awa te iwi. I te taho tōku kuraua, ko Mauna Pōhatu te maunga, ko te taurana te awa, ko te whakatāne te hapū, ko Tauanui te pā. Ko Billy Hughes rawa ko Joanna Te Tonga Anderson o kukau mātua i te taho tōku māma. Ko Beverly Hughes tōku whāia, tōku māma. I te taho tōku pāpā, he Pākehā hau. Ko Rick Carr tōku pāpā. I tipuakia ki Tāmaki Makaurau. I tipuakia a tōku māma ki konei i Tāne Atua. Ko Erin Matariki Ka tōku ingoa. E noho ana hau konei, Tāne Atua. Ko Phoebe Matariki Ka tōku mahana. Kei Sweden ia. me tāna Pepe, me tāna Tāne. He Viking ia. ko Freddie Matariki Ka taku taina. Kei whakatāne ia e noho ana. Freddie, she's a dancer. She's a hula hoop dancer.
Oh, wow.
And a librarian. So, yeah, kei konei, yeah.
I love that. Yeah. A hula hoop dancer and a librarian. Yeah. Yes.
Got to mix it, you know. Make libraries sexy. It's cool.
And your twin, Phoebe, so she's How long has she been in Sweden?
Oh, dude, like 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and she's come back. She was here for lockdown, luckily. And she has a two-year-old, our boy Leif Tordua. And so they live in a little, oh no, it's a city called Gothenburg, and she's with her partner Mikael, who's awesome, this tall Viking guy, big beard and tattoos, and he's the man. Yeah, he's real cool. Yeah, so Phoebe, she's over there, but they're coming home next year.
Awesome.
Yeah, coming home to live.
What was it like growing up as a twin?
As a twin, we were just so lucky. We grew up close by in Ohope, and went to school in Whakatane. And so we always had different friend groups, but we always had each other. So whenever we were starting anything new, you were always with that person. And I love the Māori word for twin, like mahana, that warmth, you know, and being sharing that in the womb. And sometimes I see her because we do mahi together now for one of our mahis with the New Zealand Alternative. We're co-managers. And so I get to talk to her online, and sometimes I see her and it's so weird. But I'm like, man, I've known you all my life and then some. And it's just this, even though she's so far away, just always this sense of connection. And yeah, I miss her though. Terribly sometimes, yeah.
What was your childhood like in Ohope?
Ohope, beautiful. We were always on the beach, always outside. Our dad used to boot us out all the time. He's like, get out of the house! And we didn't really, we had a little TV, but we weren't really allowed to watch, or maybe The Simpsons and Shortland Street, you know, for educational purposes. but yeah, we were always out of the house, always climbing trees. My dad's really into sailing. So we'd be out on the water. We weren't really surfer chicks, sadly, because you know how cool is that. But we'd just sort of be rocking around. We used to call them dad ventures, and go to the bush, because Ohope's got this long 11-kilometre bush in this big harbour, Ohiwa. And we grew up at a place called Ihukatia, which is actually one of our Ngāti Awa campsites. And so it was nice to be connected still to our whānau, who's actually in Te Tiko, where Kokohino is. And yeah, so we just grew up just always outside, always doing different things. Yeah, climbing trees, being on the water.
We were talking a little bit earlier about your name, and since returning home to Taniatua, you've preferred to bring Matariki into being your first name, and which I think is beautiful. And a lot of us know what Matariki is and what Matariki means and represents. But you also were telling me that your two sisters are called Matariki as well. Yeah. They have Matariki in their names because of your dad. So can you tell me a little bit about that story? Because I think it's beautiful that your dad, particularly being a, you know, a Pākehā man, wanting to name his, you know, his tamariki.
I think the story goes that was one of Mum and Dad's first conversations, because they met here in Whakatane. So Mum grew up here at Taniatua, and she spent more than 40 years working in with Māori affairs or with whenua, always protecting the whenua. And so when they first met, one of the things they first talked about was Matariki, or the Pleiades. Mm. And so Dad was, when he was sailing back in the 80s, he did a big trip right around the Pacific, and they would use sextants to guide themselves. And he said he often used to use it to go and spy Matariki, the Pleiades. And then my mum, she has seven sisters, so Matariki's always been really special to her. But my dad reckons back then he had to go to the museum to find out what the Māori kupu was for Pleiades, and found Matariki and decided that each of us would have that to keep us together, say if we did ascribe to changing our last names one day, that we'd always have this to keep us. Yeah, and so using Matariki as my name, that was actually, wasn't so much a conscious choice, it was more coming home and being in a Māori community, living in Taniatua and working in a Māori space as well is just what happens. They're like, oh, Erin, yep, that's cool. Matariki, kia ora. Okay, that's me now. And it was an interesting transition for me because I actually asked my sisters, is this okay if I use this? And then when you start introducing yourself, it was going through a stage of, oh, do I say kia ora, I'm Erin, or kia ora, I'm Matariki, and what am I allowed to claim? And it was that identity kōrero about, you know, being... being Māori and Pākehā and merging both worlds. And now I've settled, I can use both. I'm allowed. I am both. I'm allowed both. So
I can do what I want.
Yeah. It's my name. Say my name.
When you were a teen, and I find this interesting because a couple of our recent nuku wahine have had experiences going to school overseas, or their tamariki are heading to go and study overseas. And when you were a teen, you went to Venezuela.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh, dude, so cool. So AFS exchange. And I think at Trident High School, where I went, represent, we went, there was Spanish or Japanese or te reo Māori. Mm. And so that kind of, when you go on exchange, you've got to choose. And so out of the Spanish-speaking countries, there was Venezuela. I'd never heard of it before. And about a year after choosing it, I ended up living in this beautiful place called La Isla de Margarita, which is a Margarita island. Looks like a smile. Feels wow. like a smile.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Just this really warm, beautiful Caribbean place. And I lived with the most amazing family, full-on Venezuelan family. I went to a Venezuelan school. No one spoke English. Like when I first got there, they played tricks on me. When I first got there, they told me the word pendeja meant profesora or teacher. And so they're like, yeah, pendeja is just our word for profesora. So just say, you know, buenos dias, pendeja. And I'm like, oh, okay, trying to be like this good new kid. Buenos dias, pendeja. And the face on this teacher, because pendeja is a cross between a-hole and idiot. And I'm smiling up at this person like, oh, buenos dias. And she's like, who did this? You know, knew straight away. But what I loved about Venezuela was, because I was 16 and I turned 17 over there, was that it's like a whole nother world, and they were really whānau oriented, and it was like Māori people, you know, coming back home. And then, but it was their main culture to be really about your whānau. Like every day you would have school quite early in the morning because it was so hot, and then you'd come home about 12:30 or 1, and everyone came home to have a big kai together for lunch. And that was, if you weren't home for that, you had to have a really good reason. And so they'd just always eat together. There'd always be bountiful kai, laughter, dancing, music. Like that was just their way, constantly celebrating life. And Venezuela's going through some real hard times at the moment, just politically and economically. And my whānau actually have had to leave, and they're living, most of them, in Ecuador at the moment to be safe. But that place, when I was there, even though it was one of the poorest places in the world, it was actually, had won something of being the most happy place. And I learned a lot from that, as it wasn't the material positions, it was the culture and being together and sharing and, yeah. And also, it was one of the places where all of a sudden being Māori or being Indigenous was really freaking interesting and really cool, because you grew up in Whakatane, which is a place, heaps of Māori, you know, but as a teenager, and I think this is quite common, it was like shameful to be Māori, because unless you had that tight identity, you were like represented in all these negative statistics. So if you're Māori, oh, well, you're going to be more likely to go to jail, probably more stupid, you're unhealthy, you're all these things. And so people would, you know, never really celebrate it. When I was over there, they're like, what kai do you eat? what's your word for this? And like, you know, and I started to really fall in love with our culture and how unique and how beautiful, and seeing these people actually take a real big interest and love for it. So it really helped me transform as a person, I think. Because by the time I got home, I was like, it just felt like the whole world, because I'd just seen such a new side, like coming back to little old Whakatane. Yeah, it was just so, I'd just sort of grown a lot, I suppose.
That's
that
awesome.
Yeah.
You came back and you decided to study law?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the attraction to law?
Law, so language. So I've always loved language, and like Spanish was a big thing, and people. Mm. But to be honest, when I was looking at, you know, you get the brochures and you're choosing what to do, I was always interested in like foreign affairs and diplomacy and what it meant to be in the world and be Aotearoa. But my dad actually triple dog dared me to do law. And it's a serious dare. You know, triple dog dare is like a really serious thing. And so, yeah. And so I tried it out and it was hard as, because I went to Victoria University, and it was this that first year is hard because it's a mind game as much as it is the subject of law, and you're learning Western legal systems, and we're in the old government buildings, very colonial setting, and you're using academic English. So there's already all these barriers in terms of just being in the space and then receiving the information, and you don't see anything reflected apart from our awesome lecturers, Dr. Carwin Jones and Marmady Stevens and Kathy Irons. They've all like create space, and there's more and more. Mm. Like Tikanga is now going to be part of the law degree. Yes, shock eloquence.
Finally.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so that helped, but yeah, it was a really interesting transition into actually law school and finding out what law is anyway.
Mm.
You know, you think of a court and a gavel and those weird wigs where you're like, why do we wear those? And, you know, and yeah, so these images that we have of what law is, or Boston Legals, our other reference.
Oh, yes.
You know, and
when
so
they're,
learning.
When they're all drinking, what is that?
Oh, they're like whiskey on the deck.
Yeah, whiskey on the deck and cigars and old white men. Yeah. I mean, law to me is quite often old white men. Even though I know so many amazing Indigenous women that do law, I still look at law as like old white men.
Yeah, old white men. Old white men in power making decisions for everybody.
Mm.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And that's actually a lot of where our mahi is now, is why is that the norm? When we think about law, because now that I've kind of gone through my degree and then had some time working in corporate law with up in Tāmaki with Te Waka Ture in Chapman Tripp, which was excellent. And then coming home and being like, you know, slowing down my pace from an Auckland pace to a Tāneatua pace. and starting to really look at it, it's actually all about relationships. You know, laws, how we relate to each other. So what are our rules of engagement? How do we relate? And especially how do we relate to the whenua? So with Western law, we relate as a property owner. You know, I own land, this is my property, or I'm a shareholder and this is my shares in this thing here, and it makes money for me, it's productive. I have rights over this land, and that's how we relate. Whereas in a Māori, in a Te Ao Māori or Indigenous perspective all around the place, we relate, Papa Tuanuku is our mother, we are her children. To be an owner is actually kind of arrogant, right? Mm. Think about it, assuming that superiority. And we actually have responsibilities to the whenua. So that's more of our relationship as a child with responsibility. So, yeah, I just think more about law as relationships than, well, I try not to think about old white men anymore.
What was your attraction? And maybe it's not, the attraction might not be the right word, but why did you come home? Because, you know, there are so many Māori that are in the big cities that are there for mahi, that, you know, we have to live in the big cities to pay our bills and live our lives in the world that we're living in.
Mm.
And it's not often that you get people who do go home. Lots of people want to go home and they want to resettle back and give back to their whānau and their papakāinga and their people. But not many are actually able to.
Yeah.
What was it for you about coming home?
There are a few factors. But one thing I recognised when I was in that corporate environment, and I'm really appreciative for all that I learned there, and the people were amazing, but I realised that I was kind of going to be on this track of being a Māori lawyer. And here we are with tikanga becoming more and more part of our legal system. And I was being asked questions about tikanga and the law. And I was like, I don't know. But I could see that that would be my trajectory.
Mm.
And I didn't feel like I was, like I could have probably bluffed my way. And but I realised that actually that's not authentic. And I don't know and I want to know. Like I want to come and learn about what are our legal systems and how do we operate in this in this modern day, like I was in a corporate team, so we were looking at, say, post-settlement governance entities and also like the businesses that we're creating as Māori. And now our Māori economy is like $60 billion, like booming. So we've got this huge kind of huge efforts from other organisations, like the big boys, like Fonterra, ANZ, like our banks and stuff, they're all wanting to learn te reo Māori because they all want to be part of this economy. So there's this space there then to like kind of talk about tikanga and the law and contracts. And I was like, oh, nah, I don't know. I want to... And then it made me turn inwards and realise I actually don't know like who, what this means to me and what this means for our society, our community, if we're going to be sort of making these promises of like operating in a Māori way, but we're still operating in a capitalist system. Mm. How are those things actually reconciling? And the second big reason was to come and work with Te Uruwera Act. So in 2014, Te Uruwera became her own legal person. And I was like, what is this magic? This is amazing. What does that mean? And in 2017, which was the year I came back at the end of that year, Te Kawa o Te Uruwera was released. And this is the management plan under the Act, and it's Te Kawa o Te Uruwera. Like, kawa, that's law. That's our law.
Mm.
And what it means is instead of being, you know, resource management, it's human management for the benefit of the whenua. So it's a whole flipping up our relationship with the land from managing resources to actually having a relationship that's akin and it's enforceable. It's real in our Western legal system, these two hui ways of seeing Te Uruwera. So it's like fascinating. Mm. So I came to learn about that and actually came back as a policy writer for Te Uru Taumatua to try and implement what that means. You know, yeah. So
Te Uru Taumatua is the post-settlement entity for the iwi. And we have a huge number now of post-settlement entities across Aotearoa. And I was actually having a conversation with a non-Māori who messaged me and we were looking for some pūtea whanuku and she unwittingly said, you know, why don't you ask the iwi? They have lots of money. Mm. And I was like, yeah, maybe what people see from the outside of what post-settlement entities are and what we know from the inside are quite different things. And I have... in my personal experience, have worked, oh, not worked, we've been dragged along.
I had a feeling. No.
So I was an interim trustee on our iwi trust for a little while to help establish, you know, get it through a transitioning point and get it over to a new place. And so I understand a lot of the politics that come with that and all the internal raru that comes with that. And I think people just expect that because we're Māori and Māori get grouped into one big lump of people that we're all supposed to agree and we're all supposed to think the same and we're all supposed to want the same. And I find the settlement process myself fucked is probably the best word. I despise settlement and the kōrero of settlement. I don't think that we shouldn't have settlement or the benefits of settlement, but I don't like the idea of settlement because, you know, A, we never get what we're actually entitled to. B, there's just all this other raru that comes with it. We're fighting against each other in varying ways to see who has mana over which parts of which whenua when actually the whenua has the mana. And then at the end of it, we have to create this entity that's still... abides by a Western system.
Crown-mandated entity.
That's right. And so, you know, no matter how much we try, and I have so much respect for people who have gone through that settlement process and who do the hard yards for their iwi to get them there. I have huge respect for them. The process itself is fucked.
It's traumatic.
Yeah.
And it's, often people come out traumatised.
Yeah. And and there's a flow-on effect of that trauma.
Yeah. Totally.
And then we're supposed to believe that once we're post-settlement, that everything's going to be great.
Yeah, oh, switch, yeah, flick. Everything's sunny now.
Yeah. And by the time this podcast comes out, the situation may have changed. But recently, while we're here, there have been issues around Te Uru Taumatua and representation and what the people want and what the post-settlement entity is doing, and those are conflicting ideas.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that, because you have worked for the entity, you've experienced that, you live here in Taniata in the middle of it all.
Yeah.
I'm really eager to hear your kōrero around this topic.
Yeah. Cool. Well, just first on a couple of the points that you just shared, like the money thing, people don't realise that there's more money like spent every year on incarcerating Māori than there is on the whole history of treaty settlements, and that whole thing of a billion better things. And then the treaty settlements in itself, like I think it was Moana Jackson, who we love.
Love that.
We love that man.
If only he could be an Indigenous wahine.
Yeah. We'll just have to create some there. But yeah, he treaties are meant to be honoured, not settled.
That's right.
But you're right, like the benefits of settlement, this is still an opportunity for us to grow from and nurture from and move on, I suppose, move on from. Yeah, with down the road, yeah, we've had protests recently, and there's always two sides to the story and everything, but what the image that sticks in my mind of the recent protest was there's our big, beautiful building, Te Kura Whare, and then there's our kaumātua sitting on the hill on the other side facing the whare. Tameiti with his chair, his turu, that was his exhibition, chair. Again, he took this chair and he goes, you know, who's on the chair? Do you want to be on the chair? What is the chair? You know, he was trying to get people, provoke people to talk about what is this power structure we have where we have a chair, a chairman or chairperson, and then this trustees, and we have these ways of governing and making decisions. But yeah, so in this image, there's our whare, there's our kaumātua, and then in the middle are truckloads, literally, of rubbish. And that's what that image sticks in my mind as, like, visually representing what's happening right now. There's truckloads of rubbish that have been dredged up from Ohine Matarua. They were brought in there by TUT, and that's kind of what's happening. It's rubbish is between us instead of dialogue. There was no dialogue, and there isn't any dialogue. And that's the problem, is we're in this post-settlement stage right now, and we need to be nurturing ourselves and growing, but we're still kind of in fight mode, and which makes sense. You know, we've had settlement as a fight. That's a negotiation. It's a fight. We're trying to convince them that we deserve what is already belongs to us and what we belong to, the whenua, our communities, our resources, whatever it is that we need to thrive. And we've just come out of this hectic fight. And yeah, it's true, we settled in 2014, so we're 2021 now. It's that 6-7 years of settlement. That's not a long time to create the community or the nurture. But we're not talking. And so that's what I see there, is instead of actually having dialogue where we're able to build together and meet people where they're at, we're having an entity that is a Crown-mandated entity, and it's got all the resources and power. Like, you know, I respect what's been achieved there. It's amazing that Te Uru Uira Act in particular is incredible. It's actually unbelievable that we were able to achieve that in the settlement itself. But we're not living up to, I don't believe, we're not living up to the values that we're trying to preach, because if we were, then why is that image there? Why are we only have rubbish between us? And this was only a couple of weeks ago.
And it's not something that is unique to Tuhui.
No.
Well, and that's the reason why we're talking about it, is that this happens across the country with many iwi, because the structure is still a Western structure.
Exactly.
And do we even know what a Māori structure looks like? Have we explored that?
Yeah.
What could that look like? Like, what might it look like from your perspective and your experience?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And fortunately, it's quite live like this. I connect that question to constitutional transformation, which is a real living discussion right now, particularly among young people and particularly about, among wahine. Mm. I've seen so many wahine being like, you know what, kind of sick about all these details and looking at all these issues. What is the system doing? And what we see with settlement is that it's Crown designed process. They've already set all these rules, like the fiscal envelope back in the 90s, and we all went to the streets for that, you know. And then they've gone and designed these legislation and these structures of like trusts and, you know, decision making boards, and there's one chairperson. Like, did we, you know, and then there's yeah, sorry, I could go on. I'm like trying to peel back all the details. And then on the other side, we have community. And this is something I heard recently is like, okay, the same community that's up here on these boards now, there's people at the other end there that are being incarcerated over and over and over again and going through methamphetamine addiction and whānau violence and mental health. And then we've got others on the governance boards making decisions. And there's this disconnect between these two aspects of our community, but we are the same people. So big question what you ask, like what's the answer? It's hard to say, but what the process is, I think, is more about that nurturing. So I think it's the answer's less important than actually the process of coming together with this sense of nurturing, of growing together, of recognising where we're at in this point in history, and also looking back at our history. So we need to understand we were colonised, we are colonised peoples, we live in a colonised reality. Where the hell did they come from? Like, where did that mindset come from that's now dominating our normal? And where have we come from? Like, where are our value systems? Where are the things that guided us? Our kawa, our tikanga, our ways of being, our kai, you know, like all of these things that are actually our daily practices. Yeah. And so there's one real cool book that I super recommend, Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown. She's on. And she talks about like fractals. And it's the same, we talk about it because our hapu and we like little ecosystems in ourselves. And another Moana Jackson thing is hapu is where the power lies, and hapu being, you know, sub-tribe, but also being pregnant, it's like swelling with life. Like that is the place, the natural place that is swelling with life. And so life-altering decisions should be made there. And that ecosystem of a hapu, of how we come together, how we know each other, how we relate to each other and to the whenua, because it's all the same thing, is like our source of power. And if we can come back to those places and nurture ourselves and grow, then we'll get to the answer. But if we keep slaying each other with this lateral violence crap, and we keep upholding these Western institutions and not even understanding why we have them in the first place, and then we just, you know, like kind of keep catering to this capitalist system, then we're never going to return to our value systems and our ways of being, because we're not practicing that on the daily. We have to do it at the smallest level, and then it'll grow into a bigger level.
And that's such a powerful kōrero. And when we think about, there's also a fear that collective decision making, wider collective decision making, takes too long. And so if we involve everybody in the decision making, it will just take too long. And so we have to have people who can make fast and hard decisions for everybody on behalf of everybody and get us progressed and moving. And it's like, but why?
Yeah.
Like, what are we progressing to and for, and like, why?
Yeah. And that, you know, that was, for me, I learned that slowing down thing, coming to Taniata, slowing down, and then realising actually, yeah, why do we move at this fast pace? We're so conditioned to be productive and to do these chop, chop, let's go. And I think with that decision-making thing, like, I think one thing we can recognise is making a decision is like you bringing through people, and people aren't just these physical bodies. Like, we have our Māori, our mana, our wairua. We're actually joining together consciousness to create decisions for ourselves. And if we start seeing decision-making as this blend of consciousness, as we're coming to create something that's beneficial for all of us, that's going to take us in the right direction, that's the priority. It shouldn't matter how long it takes. And if we start really knowing each other and building relationships and nurturing ourselves, it probably wouldn't even take that long. Mm-hmm. Like, we're only thinking of collective decision making from a Western lens, where we're like, oh, bloody hell, I don't want to go around to all the hooey and no doings. It's like, well, the doey should be building relationships, because that's where it all starts from. And once, like, say if you're with your mates, you know, like if I'm with my mates, we can come together, we could pull anything together, because we have that strength in our relationship, makes us resilient, means that we can create great things, you know? Yeah, look at this team right here in this room, you know? Hard out. And so that's the priority, I reckon, for us, is really getting to know ourselves and being, like, healing, because we've all been through some real traumatic intergenerational shit.
I want to talk to you a little bit about that and about the creating this amazingness, because this is a beautiful segue. But you had said to me that, I mean, 2020 and 2021 have been big years for you, and that 2020 was a pivot point in your life because you were confronting kaupapa of identity, that you were reconnecting with te taha wairua, that you deepened into community of, you know, healers and gardeners and artists and activists and academics, which we all want to be surrounded by. And River, which is the mahi that you're involved in now, has also been emerging. And so your role as the co-manager for New Zealand Alternative,
yes,
is that
that's
right?
One kaupapa,
so that's one kaupapa. And then your role with River is, and I'm just going to flip this over because you are the co-lead for River, and I want to get it right, which is revitalizing Indigenous values for Earth's regeneration. What is, like, that already gives me warm fuzzies. But I want to talk to you about this kind of 2020-21 year of transition and then this mahi, because it all just connects and it all creates. So
cool. One of the biggest is that divine timing, you know, in all the ways. That's definitely been a big reality for me this past year. Yeah, so the identity thing, and I'm lucky because more and more people are talking about this, especially Wahine Māori. I've seen a lot of it on Instagram and stuff, where people are, we're both Pākehā, we're Māori, we're colonised and coloniser, we're all these mix of things, and it gets real tense sometimes to reconcile that within ourselves, let alone within our communities, our whānau, our friendships, our lovers, our whatever. And so for me, it was really challenging, and this was something that I had down the road at my old mahi, because I was there at TUT for 2 years, and it was challenging to land in a place that wasn't, well, nurturing this kind of reconnection back to self. It was how to hui are you as a key question. And it was maybe intended to be something else, but the effect of it, if it wasn't surrounded by nurturing and aroha, it was really damaging, because that's totally what we have internalized in us, is like, well, I don't know how to, am I even allowed to be here? And by the end of my time there, I felt like I had nothing I could contribute. And many people feel that way, and that's just part of the lateral violence, and it's not unique to TUT or to Tūhoe. But it's something that's part of our reality, and we need to move on from that stage that is designed and created to be like that. Lateral violence is a legit thing, and we need to move on from it and get back to nurturing, not being jealous, but being celebrating of ourselves. And so one of the impacts of me was that my skin, I was uncomfortable in my skin, and I was covered from head to toe in eczema, just rampant. Like, I wouldn't be able to get, you know, I was so uncomfortable physically. And when I started learning about the taha wairua, I realised that because of what was happening inside me, like this identity politics and overthinking, my wairua had actually slowed down. She was actually a bit detached from me. She was through the back, and she needed to come back and come back and join with my body. And we believe that the wairua, our body sits inside our wairua, and that's how we connect to the world around us, to our people, is through our wairua. And that's how we can sense our intuition, our sense of justice. All of those things come through the wairua. And so once I started learning about that, learning about how to, again, slow down, drink water, you know, nurture myself, and then I decided I need to surround myself with people who are doing that, who are nurturing as well. And that's where I found the gardeners, found healers. I found just beautiful people trying to build something without imposing anything. So they wanted to unfold a reality for ourselves without imposing a plan. So that was a big lesson for me too. Imposition is a real colonial thing where we just go, oh, okay, like look at Christchurch and Dunedin. You know how they're weirdly designed? Because they've just gone and drawn.
They're like grids or whatever. Like Christchurch is very gritty. Oh, no, actually, no, it was, and now it's now, different. Oh, but
yeah. Yeah. Well, Dunedin, they went and like, what, designed Dunedin over in England or whatever, and then just imposed that design on the whenua over there. So no relationship with the land, no unfolding of where things should be, what activities take place in what places. Mm. It was just an imposition. And we do that to ourselves. Like we impose expectations on each other. We impose, identity is really tied up in all of those things, and it's tied up in our language as well, how we express ourselves. And language, in that sense, and this is why I love art and I love storytelling, is because language is everything from our sight, our smell, our taste, our touch, and our reo. It encompasses all of those things. And I feel like once I started giving myself permission to express myself, and say things like, because I got to a point where I didn't know what I wanted. Like, I've got this little story that I share. I was in a cafe and I was stressing out. I didn't know if I wanted flat white or a latte, or like I didn't have this permission inside myself to choose what I wanted or what I liked. And I realized that that little stress out in a cafe was actually echoed in all these really important ways through my life. And so once I started to realize actually expressing myself and owning my decisions and being able to, I started to reclaim my mana and started to stand stronger and started to make decisions for myself. And I think creativity in whatever form, whether that's cooking or painting or singing, is actually a release point for us to start to express ourselves and start to identify ourselves for ourselves and then as a family and then as a, you know, outwards. And so I've got all these amazing people around me who just are peaceful and they're there to... you know, meet you at the face value, not with all these assumptions about, oh, she thinks she's all that. Oh, she's a lawyer, eh? Oh, yeah, she's probably too clever for us. Or, you know, like that kind of buzz, that bad buzz, which is, you know, all good, understandable, but that's, again, a symptom of lateral violence and of pretty much hating ourselves. You have to fall back in love with ourselves, you know? And it's an ongoing thing, like I'm not, you know, not there yet, but I'm practicing it, and I think that's what I would want for all of my mates and all of my whānau. And
it's so important because we do forget that. We do forget to look after ourselves.
Yeah.
And the importance of looking after ourselves.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about the mahi that you're doing at the moment and how amazing it is?
Yeah. Oh, it's so cool, man. And it's so cool to be alive at this time, you know, in this century and with these people, because we're at a real transformational time. And, our friend Nahuya Murphy, Nuku 66, everybody, she talks about this too. We're like called in at this time. It's a transformative time. And so there's all this creativity, but there's also this ability to work as a contractor. So I can work from home. I don't have to sell my time, my 40 hours to a 9-to-5 in order to have my security to live. we can be more creative. And so my mahi's a bit all over the place. I'm definitely still in like a listening mode and observing and trying to pull in info. And so, like you mentioned before, I'm co-manager for the New Zealand Alternative with my twin sister Phoebs, and that mahi there is focused on Aotearoa's role in the world. And one of our big projects that we're working on this year, and we've almost got it funded, is called Te Kaunoti Hika Hika, which is like this rako that lights the fires. Mm. So we want to ignite conversations, or e hika for short, which I was like, cool. And that's about constitutional transformation. So trying to figure out. What are these other alternatives to like this way that we're living, the systemic, you know, our constitution is the set of values that guide us, and it's like the set of values that we agree to live by. And currently Te Tiriti o Waitangi is the foundational document, but we do not honour that in its fullest. We kind of summarise it into neat treaty principles, and then we use those to kind of really nullify down any actual transformational change. And we just kind of, we're honouring Te Tiriti. We give you a seat at our board table, but we still operate in the same way largely. So we wanted to ignite conversations to actually talk about the system of power and decision making we have, this governance, parliament, court systems, Westminster, what the hell, and then our own law of kawa and tikanga, kupe's law, our ways of being, and this new kind of era that we're in since the 80s of this resurgence of kawa and tikanga through our Western legal system. So these days you can't talk about the Resource Management Act without talking about kaitiakitanga, for example. And like, what does that mean? Instead of siloing that to just an environmental, we're looking at the constitution, we're like, what does it mean to actually start introducing these concepts? Like, what are the risks inherent within mixing tikanga and Western law? And then what are the opportunities to actually start to evolve our legal system into something that's really going to shift and transform our society, so we're not constantly battling addiction and violence and incarceration. We're actually moving on to a place that honors. So that's NZA. And it's cool to just note that and all the amazing people in that crew and in that wider crew. And then River, which is probably more what I should talk about today, is this really wonderful group, really kind of originates with my friend Jody Gustafson, who's just this amazing woman. She's from the Yukon. She grew up on the land. The Yukon gets to like negative 40 degrees Celsius.
Oh my God.
It gets crazy cold over there. Wow. I know. Like, she told me a story that her mum was like, don't go outside. She just had a shower because her hair would freeze and snap off. Like that
oh
kind
my
of cold.
Gosh.
Yeah. So she's gone and she's Turtle Island. So she's rounded up people in Canada, Indigenous peoples in Canada, in the States, here in Aotearoa, and we're reaching over to Australia as well. So those are the four countries that originally rejected UNDRIP, the Declaration for Rights of Indigenous People. And then we're realising that in our collection of like lessons, successes, like Fletcher Challenge, they're over in Canada. And they have battles with Indigenous, all these different iwi over there, have their own battles with Fletcher. And so there's ways to, and they were here at Taiarahia. They wanted to clear Taiarahia, the maunga, Tami's maunga, in Mahurahura, and clear it and grow their forests over there. And so Tami actually occupied up there once. And so we want to know what's happening around the world. We want to learn from each other, not only the wins, but the losses, the struggles, because we're actually all land-based, kin-based people, and we've got so much to share.
Mm.
And so River at its heart is this collective, it's a space of collecting kōrero and learning from each other alternative ways of being. And so we've got one big project that that really looks at the origin of this Western system, because you have to really know your enemy. you gotta really know
them. Your friends close and your enemies closer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We our big mahi this year, we call it Illuminating Worldviews. And its purpose is to really look back in time at where colonization came from. And what we're discovering is it's so intertwined with this mentality that we have against wahine and against the land, where we just commodify both wahine and land. So land becomes this normal household item that you can just sell and trade like any other thing. And wahine are like owned and controlled by this patriarchal society. Like, where did that come from? And when we look back to the like Middle Ages, like legit, I was like, what? And the witch hunts that occurred. And all of this time of when we were, that's like the largest genocide in our history. And all of us have our whakapapa to those wahine, like in our white bodied, you know, allies and friends, they have this whakapapa to being colonized, but ages ago. And so their knowledge of land and rongoā and interaction is actually, it's not that they never had that, it's that it's so long ago, it was like, it's just forgotten. And that's why Indigenous peoples and our knowledge today, we need to be uplifted and revitalized, because we have these kōrero, we have these learnings living within us, alive to us, especially here in Aotearoa, where our stories are still, you know, they're just from yesterday, you know, like we've still got so much, and we have so much to share with each other, and we're stronger together. So, yeah, so River is all about looking at these histories, trying to wake everybody up to the fact that the system, this water that we're swimming in, it's hard to recognize, you know, if you're a fish in water, it's hard to know what water is because it's just your normal. You're just born into it. And so we're trying to wake people up to like, no, this isn't normal. This is like one way of doing things, and it's dominated us. Literally the language of their doctrine of discovery was about domination of land and of people. And we don't have to live like this. And these are this what we're going through now, this Anthropocene of like climate change and like all of the crises of poverty and inequality and everything is a result of being disconnected from the whenua in this way.
And the answer to all of those things lie in Indigenous knowledge.
Totally. Like actually though, because our Indigenous knowledge is connected to the whenua. So Western systems have disconnected us and tried to sell us this dream of material wealth, and it's so entrenched in us that like even when we die, right, you like have, we have our wills, and we're so obsessed with death in this weird way in the West, you know, we're kind of like death phobic, and we prepare our wills so that our material wealth will flow on, but we don't think about generational, like our whenua, you know, like saying West from a Western perspective, obviously from Indigenous perspective, we definitely do. But yeah.
Sorry. That's great. Yeah. Don't say sorry.
Cool. Yeah, I just feel like I'm going, oh, they're not. But yeah, so I see the main enemy is disconnection. This is how I try and simplify it in my head when it goes like way too big for me. Like disconnection, we're disconnected from ourselves, from our whenua, from our ways of being. And in that, we have disenchanted the earth. So this is the Western system. To the West, the earth is dead. You know, it's, the earth is not this living thing. And now science is catching up and being like, oh, actually, the earth breathes. Amazing, eh? And we're like, yeah.
I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's like this new thing where people go, you should go and stand outside on the grass and like put your feet on the grass and it's really healing.
It's called grounding. Yeah, like, it's this new practice.
Wow,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, I know.
You mean connecting to Papatsanuku is really healing? Imagine that.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And then and in that, it's like when we were colonized, one of the first things that was attacked was our wairua. You know, through Christianity, domination again, subjugating women and like uplifting, like Nahui had talked about our men, and like destroying the balance that we had between wahine and tāne and our roles. And then just like hyper patriarchal destructive tendencies towards these disconnected practices. And so one big thing, like, so that's, you know, our mission now is obviously decolonization, But the thing about that kupu is like it still centres colonisation. Yeah. And so I like to use reconnection, because whatever you give your attention to is going to grow. Mm. And so if we just keep focusing on reconnection and all the ways we can, like growing a mara, like that's I've just started growing a mara since coming back to Taniatua like 3 years ago, and it's been so healing. Like, of course, you know, but also just especially when I was feeling really anxious during those itchy days. I'd be out in the garden and just be like, holy, like just so much aroha, because you're literally connecting, you've got dirt all over your hands, there's nothing bad you can do, except maybe spray it all, but, you know, like when you're there, you're just growing and you're nurturing. And I realised that even though we're doing all this shit to Papatuanuku as humans, she still loves us. And I feel that through the mara, like when I got like a ridiculous amount of tomatoes over the summer, I'm like, holy crap, what am I going to do with all these tomatoes? There's so many tomatoes. Mm. And I realised, oh, she's so bountiful. She's giving me so much from her aroha, her generosity, that like all I can do now is share them and pass on that aroha, or bottle them and create something from them to then feed on. So it was like this, just such a lesson in learning from the whenua and then applying that as a human into my life. Like, how should I then be if this is how she treats me? How can I treat the world? And I see that as law, in the sense of that's the kawa, is that her bountiful love is the kawa, that natural law. And then the tikanga that we grow from that is then the sharing out, the generosity of, you know, I just see that as how we should develop our legal system, is by learning from the whenua and then adapting that into our own behaviours as in our own relationships as humans.
When we talk about reconnection and we talk about indigenisation, which is another word that I love to use, as opposed to decolonisation, we talk about all of these things and we have ambitions for them to become achievable. We have ambitions that this is what we're hoping to do in the world and we're hoping to change the world in this way, and these are the tools that we have and this is the way that we need to go and these are the people that we need to talk to, and we're slowly transforming, you know, one listener at a time. whoever it is. My question, though, is do you think we're going to get there? Like, do you actually think we're going to get there? And it's a big question.
Yeah. I do, and I have to. I have to think that. I have to believe that because I love this place and I love our people and it extends out, and that's how I wish to be. And I do feel, I don't know why or what it is, maybe it's Wairua or something about this shifting time, maybe it's my own bubble and it's all in my head, but I don't think so. I feel like there's this shift in consciousness where we're realising capitalism's dying, it's never worked, it's going to die off, and we need something to replace it. And it just reminds us to go back to the whenua, you know? And so I feel like there's this shift, like there's definitely interest all around the place. Like one of our mahi through river is to talk about legal personhood of Te Uruwera and of the Whananui River as an example of indigenising, because even though we're still dominated by these Western legal systems and economic systems, and I don't think we can really shake them unless we have like a violent revolution. I'm not really into violence and just not my thing. But I think that we can use them as tools to bring forward our Indigenous values. And that's what I believe. So Te Uruwera Act, for example, is a really clever way of using legislation and the power of enforcing legislation to bring forward a tūhoe perspective of the whenua. And so Te Uruwera legally owns herself. She has all the rights and responsibilities of a human. There's a board that's been appointed to be her voice with 6 tūhoe and 3 crown. So it's like, power in that. And then their kind of they have to uphold her interests as the highest things to meet. So you have to then build your intimacy with the whenua again. So even though when she became a national park in the 50s, and that was one of the worst things that could have happened to us because it literally ripped us away from our whenua and meant that we had no authority or decision-making over the space. And so our sense of responsibility for the space faded, and our sense of intimacy, our relationship with her faded as a general whole. Like, there's still whānau that hold true and, yay, like, beautiful. I'm so grateful that that's there in our history. That's there. We need to do that as a community. And so there's our kind of challenge now, is even though we have this legal infrastructure in place to actually live by our values, we need to look at our whānau and we need to heal. So, because we, many of our whānau, you know, our focus is on what's whakai tonight. You know, and that's our reality. That's our colonised reality. And so we're not going to care about what's up in the bush, you know, what's Te Rewe to act like. I don't care. I just want to feed my whānau. And so that's where we actually have to start, is nurturing, again, the whānau and then reconnecting. It all comes back to that of, in all our different ways, and becoming self-sustaining and, yeah, falling back in love with our ways and our whenua and, yeah, building our aspirations and our kids on that connection.
When we think about Indigenous women today and the diversity in Indigenous women, not just around our world, but, you know, like, obviously around our world, but here in Aotearoa, the diversity of Indigenous women within our own country, within our own rohe, within our own iwi and hapu, what does it mean for you to be an Indigenous woman today?
Ooh, that's a cool question. To be an Indigenous woman today, it's just such a powerful, I mean, I think it just makes me think of my mum and my nanny and then myself and my sisters, I guess, and my wider sisters. I think that we have a really important role to play in that nurturing of ourselves, because I know a lot of our wahine give and give and give, and we put ourselves last all the time, and we need to change that. And it means, yeah, it means that we, yeah, that's such a good question, Kane. You've been, but floored me there a little bit. I just feel like, yeah, I feel like our role as Indigenous women is really, we're embodied Papa Tuanuku. And that if we can believe that in ourselves and start to inhale that and breathe that and be that, that we will unleash something really, really powerful. Because we are, you know, we have to really, really hold that in and not give in to what we're being sold all the time about ourselves, about our looks, about our weight, about our success, or whatever it is that we have that distracts us from actually our source and our identity and power. And so, yeah, learning about ourselves, not just as the individual, but as wahine, as a collective, and then wahine as atua and wahine as Papa Tuanuku, is like, I feel like that's our mahi, is to really bring that to life in what we do and say and what we, yeah, in our mahi. And I believe wahine are the source of our lore, because we are that transition between life and death. We're that portal between the realms. So we bring life in, and then our Hine Nui Te Pō, she takes life away. And once we can not just have that as myths and legends, but have that as our centre and our belief, and feel that, you know, remember in the sense of remember in our bodies that that's who we are, then we can, yeah, we'll be so powerful. We are so powerful. I feel like we could transform everything.
You've almost answered my last question. You actually probably have answered my last question in a number of ways, but I will ask it anyway, which is, what is your hope for the future of Indigenous women?
For Indigenous wahine, well, yeah, it's that remembering our role and taking that pride in our role and in ourselves. And I think in connecting into our sisterhood, I think that's been a big lesson for me lately. And it might be something that through my 20s, I was always kind of a tomboy and I found it easier to hang with men or like boys. And I don't know what that was about. I think it's just sometimes with wahine, we have these tendencies to hurt each other, and that's not our natural, I don't think. I think that's part of that same lateral violence, and I really hope that we let all that go, unpack that and let it go, that like things like jealousy, where you can't be happy for someone else. And then we start to recognise instead that we are expressions of each other. And I've had that recently with my younger sister, Freddie. She's so cool. She's so freaking cool. Both my sisters are awesome. And she's out just, she does things. She's a Taurus. I'm a Scorpio. And she does these things for herself where she'll go out and go surfing or go paragliding or go dancing and do these things. And I used to feel like, oh, I have to keep up with that. Like that's what's called now, you know, like this sort of quite an immature feeling, but really common feeling. And it was real, so I don't dismiss it as bad. I'm just like, okay, that's really. And then I started this practice of being like, shoot, I'm glad you exist. Like, I'm so glad. And you are me. And I see you out there doing these beautiful things that I also enjoy and like admire, and that you're out there doing that. Or like even things like, oh, you're at the hui or you're at the tangi or whatever. You're representing us, that feeling of like, we are the same, but we're just different expressions of each other. I would hope that we do that for all of us, so that all our goal is that as we build each other, we're building ourselves and we feel that. And so we just want to love up, like love up instead of pull down. I don't think that's too romantic or too aspirational. I think that's probably our norm. Like, you see those old photos with kuia and they're holding hands and they walk down the street and they're holding each other. Like, why don't we do that? There's so much power in that, of having our sisters around us and like moving together and feeling the strength of each other and holding each other accountable in our sisterly ways and being cool with that. So I really hope that as a culture, as a peoples, we turn back to that loving kind of way, and that our men start to recognize that too.
That's right.
Okay, women are the strategists, the nurturers, the law holders. You guys can be the army on the ground. I think it's a lot of aroha and a lot of connection. I think that's a lot of where our power is going to come from.
That's beautiful. I just want to mahi to you and thank you for sharing with us today. Thank you for opening up your whare for three stragglers to come and hang. Yeah, the sisters. It has been a real privilege to sit here and kōrero with you, and I love the kōrero that you have shared. I am excited to see where this mahi goes. Mm. It is much needed today, and I know that, you know, just as you said, you believe that it is going to happen, and I believe it's going to happen too. So just thank you so much. I also just want to remind those that are listening that the Nuku Puka Puka it's exciting. It is available for pre-order at nukuwoman.co.nz, so you can go and check it out. The Puka Puka features all 100 of these amazing kakas, indigenous wahine, parts of their story, their beautiful images of their beautiful selves, and it is a taonga that is not only for us but is for our tamariki and mokupuna, so please go and get a copy. Tēnā koe.
Yeah, kia ora. Thank you for having me. It's such an honour to be part of this. Kia ora.
Don't forget, whānau, our book, Nuku, Stories of 100 Indigenous Women, is currently available on pre-order. Make sure you grab yourself a copy. Want to know more about our book? Nuku, Stories of 100 Indigenous Women is a powerful and important snapshot of Indigenous wahine today. Through wide-ranging voices, this ambitious social documentary allows you to obtain authentic insight into life as an Indigenous wahine in a way like never before. The stories recorded are of incredible wahine,
each offers significance to the story of mana wahine, from Oscar-nominated filmmakers and award-winning musicians to scientists, entrepreneurs, tribal leaders, artists, environmental champions, knowledge holders, mothers, and more. These nuku wahine seek to influence the world around them. The youngest is 14 and the eldest is in her mid-70s. They are wahine Māori, Moriori, Pasifika, Melanesian, Wiradjuri, Himalayan and Mexican. Order your copy today at www.nukuwoman.co.nz.